But ask yourself, if we'd learned on November 22, 1963, that the Premier of Russia had been shot from a Moscow office building by a lonely capitalist sympathizer who himself was then liquidated by a patriotic Muscovite within 48 hours while surrounded by armed police, I think it would be pretty apparent to any free-thinking person that a coup d'etat and a transfer of power had just taken place in the Soviet Union. And we would not be asking questions or attacking Jim Garrison or his record. We would, in a free-thinking society, be asking hard questions about why he was killed and what forces were opposed to him. Y'all gotta start thinking on a different level, like the CIA does. Now, we're through the looking glass here, people. White is black, and black is white.
The government's been in bed with the entire telecommunications industry since the 40s. They've infected everything. They get into your bank statements, computer files, email, listen to your phone calls, every wire, every airwave. The more technology you use, the easier it is for them to keep tabs on you. It's a brave new world out there. At least it better be.
You both were members of Skull and Bones, a secret society at Yale. What does that tell us?
Not much, because it's a secret.
Is there a secret handshake? Is there a secret code?
I wish there were something secret I could manifest.
322, secret number?
There are all kinds of secrets.
Welcome back to Cloak and Dagger. I'm your host, Lenny Bloom, along with my co-host, the great American Judge Buster, Sherman H. Skolnick. And once again, we're here to expose the state secrets that the shadow government hopes you don't learn, and scrape the bullshit off the truth. And helping us do that tonight, our regular Wednesday night briefing, the illustrious Ralph Schoenman. Ralph, it's an honor to have you back here at Cloak and Dagger. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Lenny and Sherman. It's always good to be with you.
Now, Ralph,
we're honored to have you on this program, Ralph.
Ralph,
you're going to fill us in on something that's going to help our headache pill business. But go ahead.
Well, Ralph, Ralph, you've been talking recently on your wonderful program on taking aim at takingaim.info and WBAI.org. about the coming attack and war in Iran, and how the United States is giving many signals that they're about to shift their focus. And one of the things I know everybody wants to hear more about is your perceptions and your observations about how that's going to happen. So take it away.
Well, Lenny, what we did on Taking Aim was the first part of what we call the uncivil war, which is a war between sectors of the ruling class, and it pertains to the plans of the neocons and the wing of the class that has bought us 9/11 and the particular invasion of Iraq. To replicate that in dismantling the various states in the Middle East. This has been a forward policy of direct military intervention with occupation as its basic strategic anvil that a sector of the class has had great doubts about. No less brutal is this sector. After all, we're talking here about essentially Eastern capital and the part of the military apparatus that is spoken for by George Bush's father and by the people who brought us the first Gulf War. But you'll see in the Sunday Times of London on March 13th, 2005, an important article by Uzi Mahnahimi, the Israeli journalist, and Tony Allen Mills, called Taking Aim at Iran. Israeli troops are training for an assault on Iran's nuclear facilities. Of course, there are no nuclear facilities, but we'll leave that out for the moment. We'll come back to it.
Okay.
Israel's finest soldiers are flying several hours before the assault helicopters reach their target, the uranium enrichment plant at Natanz in southern Iraq, southern Iran. The Shaldok battalion dressed in the uniform of the Iranian Pasdaran militia. Others wearing Israeli army kit carrying standard M4A carbine rifles with the Trijicon reflex sight. The helicopters drop low over the desert. The commandos adjust their night vision equipment. Large dogs from the Oketz unit strain against tightly held leashes. Close by are packs of explosives strapped to them. The choppers land several miles from the targets. The soldiers spill out, run to lorries hidden by Mossad agents. The Oketz men strap the bombs to the dogs. The article is very particular about these plans. For 10 minutes, there is a delay. The lorries clear the plant. A series of explosions is heard on the ground. Next, Israeli F-15 jets scream in dropping bunker-busting bombs. For the past months, elite Israeli commandos are training for the assault on Iran's nuclear facilities. The news that Israel is planning unilateral action to end what it calls an imminent Iranian nuclear threat is no longer secret. Israeli officials state the point of no return will come later this year when they calculate Iran will be ready to start processing uranium. And interesting about this, the preservation of a nuclear monopoly in the Middle East, they say, is the cornerstone of Israel's policy, and they lay the stage here for this completely contrived rationale. Now, what's, of course, these are the current orchestration of long-standing plans that they have been, that are being laid out not only with respect to Iran, but they have to do with what Seymour Hersh, who is the prominent investigative journalist who writes in The New Yorker. And Hersh is a long-standing conduit for Central Intelligence Agency information tied to the sector of the ruling class that's Eastern Capital-based. These are the CIA operatives and command who don't like what the neocons are preparing and consider it reckless endangerment. There's a particularly revealing article that was written by Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker in the January 24th and January 31st issues of the New Yorker of this year called The Coming Wars. And here is how he, I mean, it's a long article, and I'm going to just cite what I particularly revealing.
Well, he, in other words, 11 months ago he wrote about this?
No, yes, that's correct. But, I mean, this is something that I'm going to, that has been disclosed by William Arkin and Hersh since 2002. He says here, the Defense Department, under the leadership of Douglas Feith, is working with Israeli planners to develop and refine nuclear chemical weapons inside and Iran. And then he reveals something particularly interesting. Under Rumsfeld's plan, United States military operatives will be posing abroad as foreign businessmen buying contraband items to be used in nuclear weapons systems. Pentagon advisors inform that citizens will be recruited to join up with terrorists. This will involve organizing and carrying out combat operations and terrorist activities. These operations will take place in nations where there's an American diplomatic mission with an ambassador and CIA station chief, the Pentagon informant disclosed. The ambassador and station chief will not necessarily have a need to know under the Pentagon's current plan. The new rules will allow special forces to set up what are called action teams in the target countries overseas. Carry out these terrorist activities. Do you remember the execution squads in El Salvador? The former high-level intelligence official asked me, referring to the military-led groups that committed atrocities in the early 1980s. We founded them. We financed them. We organized them. And then the short rush goes on. We are riding with the bad boys. So what is he disclosing here? That the terrorist operations, as they call them, are in fact Pentagon operations, false flag operations. They run the operation, they stage them, they carry them out, and then they deploy them as the rationale for their prior plans. That is quite a revelation for Seymour Hersh to drop on us in the New Yorker, and it's not just in a throwaway. He spells it out, and he lays it bare. Now, someone else who has been engaged in just these types of disclosure is William M. Arkin, who is a national security correspondent who has written extensively in the Washington Post and in the Los Angeles Times. This goes back, as I mentioned, several years. Here is William Arkin on January 26, 2003, in the Los Angeles Times. The nuclear option in Iraq. The United States has lowered the bar for using the ultimate weapon. And he states, the United States is preparing the unthinkable, the use of nuclear weapons against Iraq. The United States Strategic Command, STATCOM, is organizing and planning with cells of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, target lists to be deployed for a nuclear attack. He says the Bush administration's decision to actively plan for preemptive use of nuclear weapons, including so-called bunker bombers, bunker busters, represents a significant and strategic lowering of the nuclear threshold and rewrites the ground rules of nuclear combat in the name of fighting terrorism. They have moved nuclear weapons out of a long-established special category, and they've integrated them with their major military options. Covert operations and special forces and air power and all other forms are ready to deploy the nuclear option. They have lowered the threshold, they've broken down the firewall, separating the use of nuclear weapons from everything else.
Very interesting.
And the article goes on to detail the specific plans.
Sherman?
It says in
Sorry.
Tell me something, Ralph. Remind people, if maybe they don't know, maybe we don't know. What is the justification for this? Is Iran threatening the United States? I mean, what about the countries in the Western world that have the bomb?
Let me point out, Sherman, that in this particular article and in this particular disclosure, the option is for Iraq, not Iran. So the target of opportunity is only the pretext, and much of the kind of drumbeat of propaganda that they are now preparing for Iran, namely this presumptive potential development of the capacity to make a nuclear weapon in Iran, was the same type of thing that they were presenting with respect to Iraq. And you see, this was already, here is a, to continue with this.
Yeah, go ahead, Ralph. And that, I don't want to, go, let's, okay, go ahead.
Well, I was going to make
reference
to a follow-up,
yep.
This is a piece by Paul Richter.
Go ahead.
Of Security Research called U.S. Works Up Plans for Using Nuclear Arms. Bush administration has directed the military to prepare to use nuclear weapons against seven countries and to prepare smaller nuclear weapons for use in battlefield situations, according to a classified Pentagon report obtained by the Los Angeles Times. The secret report was provided to Congress on January 8, 2002. The Pentagon is being prepared to use nuclear weapons against China, Russia, Iraq, North Korea, Iran, Libya, and Syria.
Okay, now
the weapons will be used. A copy of the report was obtained by defense analyst and Times contributor William Arkin.
Now, Ralph, let me ask you something, because you were very, very close with Bertrand Russell and was his spokesperson. What is the feeling about the use of, how can these people actually be planning the use of nuclear weapons and believe that they're going to absolutely not trigger a complete global annihilation?
Well, because the basic concept here is that American imperialism has hegemony, that they will deploy these nuclear weapons to completely subjugate and terrorize any potential resistance, and to establish their willingness to do that and demonstrate their having done it, so as to work their will. Here, for example, to come back to William Arkin, and I have to emphasize that, see, we're talking about people like William Arkin and Seymour Hersh. These are people who are plugged into the national security apparatus and are deployed as it were, disclosing assets.
Right.
And actually, as we develop and show, what both Seymour Hersh and William Arkin have been doing,
yes,
is outing the plans, and they're doing this on behalf of sectors of the class that are considering that the particular plan for the actual preemptive use of nuclear weapons is reckless endangerment of the ruling class itself.
Ralph, notice my question, which, depending how I state it, might even sound laughable. But on the one hand, we are claiming that Iran, somehow, by having nuclear whatever, is endangering us. What if Iran had parachute troops and all these other things and says, you know something, United States, you are endangering us. So maybe Iran has got the right to invade the United States secretly with parachute troops and dismantle our nuclear. I mean...
Well, that's, of course, I mean, the...
There's something stupid and also the second thing that is not laughable are stories that are circulating that part of the Valerie Plame affair, which, you know, the CIA leak case, there are contentions that her team were planning to take nuclear weapons and insert them in Iraq. And then, so you see that? They got them there. In other words, put up an excuse for what it is that we're doing there. You see what I'm saying? I mean,
no, that's not accurate, Sherman. Let me explain why. If we're going, you have to understand the players here, I think. Coming back to the question of Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame, we did a two-part series on what the Fitzgerald indictments represent. Who is Fitzgerald? And who is Joseph Wilson, and who is Valerie Plame? Please put this into proper context, namely that there is a sector of the ruling class that is linked to the Zionist state, specifically the Likud wing of the Zionist state, that has internalized the Israeli plan to dismantle each country in the Middle East into its ethnic and religious components and wants to deploy American imperial power as the instrument for accomplishing this. The Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, which the nation's Jacob Vest has documented in great detail with regard to this policy, the PNAC, the Policy for a New American Century, the American Enterprise Institute, we're talking about the whole apparatus for the World War IV plan of James Woolsey and Paul Bremer, and the role here of Defense Policy Board figures Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz, and Douglas Fife, and I. Lewis Libby, Scooter Libby, John Bolton. This is a sector that is Cheney and Rumsfeld and Baby Bush giving it their centerpiece of the policy of U.S. imperialism, which is to break up these countries and to occupy them, and to effect a direct control and a perpetual war apparatus targeting as many as 60 countries.
Oh, now just a second. I just want to get a question in, Ralph, for you also here. Are these people not worried about the fact that if the United States uses nuclear weapons in Iran, which is really on the border of the Soviet Union, that the Soviet Union, using its submarines off the coast of the United States, won't launch some sort of a retaliatory strike against the United States? Answer that question. And then could you please go into a little bit of explanation, because you're an expert. Was it not Bertrand Russell who developed the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists and the MAD Doctrine, Mutually Assured Destruction? And if so, what's happened to that? And why is that not a method of preventing this sort of thing? Go ahead.
Look, there is no Soviet Union. There is the former Soviet republics of Central Asia, and there is Russia. The former Stalinist bureaucracy has converted itself into a mafia-owning, property-owning clique that is very closely linked to American imperialism. The use of the United States of nuclear, tactical nuclear weapons in targeting Iran or Iraq will not be responded to by Russia in any way, shape, or form. But the issue here has to do with, when I was bringing up the question of Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame and Patrick Fitzgerald. Patrick Fitzgerald was the person who prosecuted the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center in conjunction with Michael Chertoff. Patrick Fitzgerald was a person working in close cooperation as the prosecutor with the Federal Bureau of Investigation office in New York. The FBI office in New York prepared the attack on the World Trade Center in 1993. Their instrument and operative, Imad Ali Salem, a high-level Egyptian intelligence operative and an FBI officer, actually went into the Mosque of the Blind Egyptian Cleric to recruit people and to bring them to meetings where the FBI operative, Imad Ali Salem, proposed there should be bombings of the World Trade Center, of the Lincoln Tunnel, the Holland Tunnel, the George Washington Bridge, the Statue of Liberty, the United Nations, the so-called landmarks plot. All of these, he went into the Mosque of the Sheikh in Brooklyn as well as in New Jersey. All of these were sting operations of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. They were false flag. As I've often mentioned, in this scheme, the FBI operative, Imad Ali Salem, wore a wire and made transcripts of each meeting in which you hear and read how he himself is proposing these operations. And he entraps young people. 50 file boxes of these transcripts were in the offices of the FBI for 6 months prior to the bombing in 1993. Fitzgerald is an integral part of this. They set up the blind Egyptian cleric, who ironically enough was part of a prior CIA undertaking called Operation Cyclone in Egypt, when the CIA was conspiring against the nationalist government of Gamal Abdel Nasser and was funding the Muslim Brotherhood, the WAFT, and funding the blind Egyptian cleric, who was one of theirs. So here he is in the United States, in exile during the Mubarak regime, essentially out of politics, and they set him up. But that's not only what Fitzgerald did. The blind Egyptian cleric was represented by a very prominent left civil liberties attorney named Lynn Stewart, an associate of William Kunstler and of Ron Ruby and of Lenny Wineglass, many of the civil libertarian attorneys who defended the Panthers and the anti-war activists throughout the 1960s. Lynn was the attorney defending the blind Egyptian Sheikh Omar, who had been set up in this fashion. Patrick Fitzgerald not only confined the blind Egyptian cleric to solitary confinement incommunicado, which is no part of his sentence. But when his attorney was there to represent him, he had the conversations between the attorney and the and her client bugged. And when the Egyptian cleric asked to communicate with his family and his friends and his followers in Egypt about what his fate was, and his attorney quite properly conducted his correspondence to its intended recipients, she was immediately prosecuted by Patrick Fitzgerald, and she is sent and threatened and charged with aiding and abetting terrorism. The first witness against Lynn Stewart, and this, after all, is an attack on the right to an attorney. It's an attack on due process. It's an attack on attorney-client privilege. It's an attempt to terrorize and intimidate any potential attorney who defends somebody accused by the state apparatus, and it is an attack on the presumption of innocence. Lynn Stewart was the first witness against her in this set-up trial against the attorney, and by the way, lawyers of every political persuasion, right-wingers, Tories, all sorts of lawyers came to the defense of Lynn Stewart in this matter because they understood very clearly that this was an assault on the judicial process and the adversary process and on the right to the entire Bill of Rights. The consequence is that Lynn Stewart was convicted and is facing 30 years imprisonment, but Patrick Fitzgerald did not stop there. He is the prosecutor of the and by the way, with respect to the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, in which he himself is a criminal conspirator, along with Michael Chertoff, Fitzgerald immediately ascribed the bombing to Osama bin Laden. This is in 1993. Osama bin Laden had no more to do with the bombing of the World Trade Center than my dead grandmother.
Sherman, you had a question for Ralph?
I got a
That's
question,
excellent, Ralph.
Ralph.
Thank you very much for that, that clarifying that for me.
We need to know about that, but Ralph, somewhere in this trial it came out that it was supposed to be only a sting operation with fake explosives. But
no, it didn't come out. What you're describing, Sherman, is what Emad Ali Salem, who was the high-level FBI operative, when Emad Ali Salem was detained, right?
Yeah.
And Emad Ali Salem was intended to finger the blind sheikh. it became clear to Emad Ali Salem that he was a sacrificial lamb. So he quickly said, well, I was assured by my superiors in the FBI that the explosives that we were provided wouldn't detonate.
He
blew the cover.
And explosives, and the only reason the building didn't get damaged severely, people were killed, is they didn't put it close enough to the pillars. Another key thing that should be pointed out is one of these people, perhaps the one you're mentioning, had a phone number where he could be reached, which was actually connected to the Israeli intelligence.
Well, what you're describing here is the safe house, which was provided by Guzi Hadass of the Mossad. And if you remember, there was a young man, Salame, who was assigned the task of renting a van from Ryder Rental Company.
Yeah.
And he went and rented the Ryder Rental van, which he brought to where he was told to bring it. And then later, he went back to get his money back from the Ryder Rental.
What kind of a spy could he have been?
Well, the man, and he was much ridiculed and in a racist fashion.
Okay,
you see these dumb Arabs. He's carrying out a conspiracy to bomb the World Trade Center, and he wants his money back yet. But it's so obvious that this kid was retained on a need to know basis. He hadn't had the faintest idea what the function and purpose of renting that van was. He was given an assignment. But that aside, it's quite right that Guzi Hadass, the Mossad operative.
My second question goes back to the earlier statement I read someplace that Valerie Plame's team supposedly was involved in putting weapons of mass destruction into Iraq to justify us invading there. You start out by saying that something I said was inaccurate.
Well, I was going to come to that, Sherman. I was first wanting to since the question of Patrick, which I, what I, to put this into its proper focus, we started out by talking about the neocon plan to, and the forward strategy of Rumsfeld within the Pentagon to legitimize the use of nuclear weapons and to integrate nuclear weapons as a forward device, an active plan, and to connect this to staging false flag terrorist operations to create the pretext for actually deploying such weapons. And then I was trying to make the point that that significant sectors, because the Central Intelligence Agency was completely bypassed in this. Not only were they bypassed, but Rumsfeld, through his Pentagon operation, was setting up a parallel covert capacity by units answerable only to his neocon cabal and himself. Central Intelligence Agency was being sidelined in this. See, the Central Intelligence Agency being closely tied to the principal sectors of capital. And one of the major spokespeople for this is George Bush Sr. and Scowcroft, General Shinseki, significant sectors of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and so on. So, and the point I'm trying to make about this is that there is a civil, an uncivil war, not unlike that which underlay the execution of John Kennedy, or for that matter, Watergate and the entrapment of Richard Nixon. Here you have, however, central...
Ralph, what needs to be clarified is a simple thing. So what I mentioned, is that itself inaccurate, that she was supposed to, her team, Valerie Plame's team, was supposed to supposedly help Bush justify an invasion by putting weapons of mass destruction into Iraq that were not there?
No, that is not correct. The opposite is the situation when we come to Joseph Wilson and Valerie Plame.
Yeah.
Good. Let's let Ralph go into that, Sherman.
Okay,
let's
but wait a minute. One more simple question. So in your judgment, to clarify this, do we understand that you have no confidence whatever in the special prosecutor because of his background?
Is it not a question of his background? What you have to understand here is that the so-called special prosecutor and the targeting of Libby or Cheney or Rove or any of these people around the question of outing Valerie Plame and Joseph Wilson is an expression of the war between CIA and the main sector of the ruling class and the neocon apparatus linked to Cheney and Bush Jr. and Rumsfeld and the this whole Jinsa Likud neocon cabal, as they have been aptly called.
In other words, you're putting it into better clarification of what the hell we're dealing with here.
Neither of these sectors has anything to offer except misery and oppression to the mass of our people. Both sectors are equal enemies of the rights of all. But I want to just elucidate this a little bit. Fitzgerald, just to finish for a moment with who Patrick Fitzgerald is,
and this is very important, and we're going to extend our time, Ralph, for another 20 minutes, whatever. So take your time, and let's. This is very important. Go ahead.
Yeah, tell us about Fitzgerald. Tell us.
Well, I began to expose or disclose that, you know, you have to remember that Fitzgerald has been lionized by the liberals, by Amy Goodman on Pacifica, Democracy Now, by Alexander Coburn in Counterpunch, by all of this liberal sort of social democratic milieu who forget everything and they learn nothing. They're always picking and choosing from amongst their oppressors the soft cop of the moment who was the hard cop of the day before. But the point again here to clarify just what this is about. You want to understand the forces that are involved in the false flag operations like 9/11 or the 1993 bombing? Fitzgerald is right at the center of it, along with Chertoff and the very apparatus on which he is now turning. One other manifestation of this was the 1998 bombings of the United States embassies in Nairobi and Dar es Salaam. The prosecutor for that was the same Patrick Fitzgerald. They met again in 1998, imputing these events to Osama bin Laden, when even the Israeli press, Haaretz and Yedioth Ahronot, had disclosed that the Israeli Mossad had prior precise details of the plans for the bombing of those two embassies a month before, as did the United States intelligence services. The San Francisco Chronicle has documented that the point man for the bombing of the embassies at the time was a high-level CIA operative, FBI operative, trained at Fort Bragg for decades, who was not only the coordinator of those events, but had been assigned by CIA to provide the bodyguards for Osama bin Laden. That's the San Francisco Chronicle. This is not in the forefront of revolution.
No, wait,
and the point I'm trying to make here is that for anybody to misunderstand who Fitzgerald is and what he represents and what this internecine conflict is about in the targeting of Rove or Cheney or Libby or any of these people, it has to do with the Night of the Long Knives. It's like the SA and the SS. And it goes to the question of the role of who, or to put it correctly, who is Joseph Wilson? Who is Valerie Plame? Joseph Wilson, to come back to your question about the relationship to Iraq, at the time of the first Gulf War under George Bush Sr., which was the implementation of a policy of every administration for four decades of preparing for the direct seizure of Arab oil. When it came to setting up Saddam Hussein, at the time of the antecedent months in the, prior to the first Gulf War, if you recall, the United States had instigated Saddam to attack Iran after the overthrow of the Shah.
Right.
The assignment given to Saddam Hussein on behalf of the United States, who were his master, he'd been their man in Baghdad for 27 years, was to amputate the oil-producing province of Iran in Khuzestan and to undertake that invasion. Leaving aside all the particulars of that, during the war between Iran and Iraq, when the United States and Israel are arming both sides, to, as Kissinger said, to bleed them both white, the Emir of Kuwait moved his arbitrary frontiers 900 square kilometers north till it was sitting on the largest oil fields of the Ramah oil fields of Iraq. He then bought a company from in California, the Santa Fe Drilling Company in Alhambra, California, paid $2.3 billion and got horizontal drilling equipment that drilled out about $14 billion of Iraqi oil. The two main beneficiaries of that were the very same Brent Scowcroft, National Security Advisor of Bush Sr., and Mossbacher, Robert Mossbacher, Bush Sr.'s Secretary of Commerce. Now, Bush Sr. and Scowcroft and Mossbacher and the sectors of the Joint Chiefs that are aligned with them are the very opponents and the people who have set Patrick Fitzgerald into motion. Let's look at the role of Joseph Wilson in Iraq. At the time, the ambassador to Iraq, to Baghdad, from the United States, was April Glasby. Yeah. It's April Glasby who's supposed to have conveyed the message from James Baker and George Bush Sr. to Saddam, go ahead and rectify the border with Kuwait. They fucked you over. Take back what has been taken from you. We understand. If the actual person who conducted those talks was not April Glasby, it was Joseph Wilson.
Wow.
April Glasby was sent on vacation.
Where was that revealed, Ralph?
The role of Joseph Wilson,
well,
and where
Sherman,
we documented that.
Let's let Ralph finish. And
yeah, go ahead.
Let's
now.
Let Ralph
I'll be glad
finish
to,
because
I mean,
I'm not worried about his sources. Ralph,
yeah,
I want Ralph
ahead,
to give us.
But
this,
I'll be glad to give you the.
We can get them
the
later, Ralph.
The
we'll
role
get
of Joseph Wilson, because you'll find it in Vanity Fair. In a long
Ralph.
Two-part, the 40-page article about Joseph Wilson and what Valerie Plame.
Ralph, go ahead. We don't need your background right now. Please go ahead. Fine.
So, yeah, go ahead, Ralph. Go ahead.
So Joseph Wilson is the point man. He actually has the direct discussions with Saddam Hussein and Tariq Aziz after the relatively small number of Iraqi forces, Republican guards, have crossed over the northern border of Kuwait. There's a meeting face-to-face with Saddam, Tariq Aziz, and Joe Wilson. Wilson says, okay, you guys, you got your troops there. We've got our fleet in the Gulf. Now turn over your oil to us. See? And you watch how this unfolds. They now have their pretext for bombing Iraq into total subjugation, but their game plan, Bush Sr. and the CIA and that sector of capital, is not to invade or occupy Iraq. That's the last thing they want to do. They want the same repressive apparatus that they'd helped set up under Saddam Hussein to continue to subjugate that country without Saddam. They have demonized Saddam. Now they want him removed, just like they did with Noriega, and they want another puppet in his place. That's the game plan. If you look at, let's just take a moment.
Sherman, I want Ralph to finish this. Let's just sit in the background and let's let him go, please. Go ahead, Ralph.
Just take a look at where of Joseph Wilson and who he is. Joseph Wilson, who is a high-level figure in CIA and in their covert operations division, just like his wife, Valerie Plame, Joseph Wilson was the ambassador to, he's an Africa man. It's not only Middle East. He was the ambassador to Gabon. He was the ambassador to Niger and Chad and Burundi. Francophone Africa, particularly Francophone Africa, where the oil is. He is assigned to President Bongo in Gabon. But Gabon has sweet, light crude oil in plenitude. But the French Total Company had the inside track on this because of the, being a former French colony and the French security apparatus in Gabon. The Clinton administration deploys Joseph Wilson as the ambassador to Gabon. The cabinet is replaced, and Bongo is basically told, you want to stick around? You want to see the smell of daisies? You play ball with us. Gabon and its oil now are basically run by the U.S. He then moves on to the country of Niger. Now, Niger is the presumptive location of the yellow cake. 1 week after the ambassador, Joseph Wilson, arrives in Niger, the president of Niger is assassinated, and the replacement officer meets with Ambassador Joseph Wilson for the cabinet to be put in place by the ambassador from the United States. All of this is baldly and blandly set out in Vanity Fair and in other places. He provides the same services in Chad and in Burundi. Now we're talking about Rwanda and Burundi. These are the locations of the massacre, the genocide that prepares for the displacement of Mobutu in Congo and the pushing out of Belgian and French interests in Congo and the consolidation of control by American imperialism. Joseph Wilson is a point man, high level, for Central Intelligence Agency. When he goes to Niger, nominally and putatively to investigate the supposed and questioned legitimacy of the yellow cake, you recall the yellow cake raw material for nuclear, for producing fissionable nuclear materials that is supposedly being going from Niger to Iraq. The official fiction has it that Joseph Wilson was sent there by Cheney and by Bush. Not true. Joseph Wilson was sent there by the direct superior of Valerie Plame of Central Intelligence. Not only was he sent there in that capacity, but he reported back, neither to Bush nor to Cheney, but he was debriefed by the head of by Valerie Plame's superior in covert operations of Central Intelligence. More interesting than that, with respect to the Niger, the yellow cake that entrapped Bush and Cheney in Niger, Seymour Hersh comes to the rescue once again with an extraordinary disclosure. He, in the New Yorker, the plan for representing that Niger yellow cake was being sent to Iraq and was the basis for the preparation of a nuclear weapon in Iraq. And if you remember the famous statement by Condoleezza Rice, "We don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud over New York City."
Yep. Yep.
Apropos.
Yep.
The disclosure by Seymour Hersh is the following. He has the top covert operatives in CIA in a meeting, and they're all chuckling together. "Wow, that was cool. We set those dumb sons of bitches up all right." The people who authored the Niger Cake apparatus and plan was the CIA themselves, the very people to whom Joseph Wilson was answerable. And Seymour Hersh spells it out. "We knew that these dumb bastards would bite. We knew that Cheney and Rumsfeld would say, we've got what we need." They set them up with a ludicrously and easily exposable fake story. As soon as they bite, as soon as they've gone with it and they put it in Bush's State of the Union message, as soon as Colin Powell is instructed to make that the centerpiece of his speech before the United Nations, the same people who set up the fake operation in Niger, where Mr. Wilson had been the ambassador and the effective ruler of the country, why, Wilson is sent right back there by his CIA covert operative boss to investigate the very thing they'd set up, and he comes back and he publishes something in the New York Times before he's even talked to Bush or Cheney, so he's been debriefed, in which he says this whole thing was fake. There were no masks. There was no Niger yellow cake. This was bad intelligence at the expense of the real intelligence providers, the Central Intelligence Agency. He entraps Cheney and Rumsfeld exactly the way he did Saddam Hussein at the time of the first Gulf War. What about his wife?
Yeah. Ralph, I understand that Iraq had their own yellow cake, uranium ore. It didn't need somebody else's yellow cake.
Well, it's not only, Iraq has...
Let's see if we can clarify this a little bit. What you were saying is, Fitzgerald, there's no basis to lionize him. Secondly, there is, if I understand what you've said, and it's really devastating, there is no basis to assume that Valerie Plame and or her husband have been victimized. Have I got it straight?
Well, I mean, what we're talking of is if they're each victimized. I mean, the only victims are the peoples of the world. These are the thieves falling out amongst themselves or having an internecine fight. But what we're really looking at here is the following. The plans of the neocons for World War IV, their very invasion of Iraq itself, which had been opposed by Scowcroft, opposed by Bush Sr., opposed by the architects of the first Gulf War, the military commanders of the first Gulf War, as reckless endangerment. "We don't want to take ownership of Iraq in the sense of having to run it with a military and face a national insurgency like we did in Vietnam. Haven't we? What are you, nuts? You're going to recapitulate what happened to us in the 60s? We're going to do it all over again? No way. You got to be nuts. That doesn't fly."
But Ralph,
what
is implicit in what you said, please clarify if I got it wrong, for reasons of politics or whatever the hell, the CIA has gotten Bush and Rove and that pack of thieves into a bind. Have I got it wrong?
No, I mean, so they set them up. Look, yes, the basic dynamic is the following. You have a division within the class. There's a sector of the rulers that are linked to the forward strategy of the Zionist state and the Israelis to actively dismantle each Middle Eastern country, dismantle them, dismantle their ruling cliques, carve them up into ethnic and religious components, send in the U.S. Army to administer the place, and to do that not in one country but in a series of countries, and to have weapons, enormous weapons of total destruction, to enforce their will and to terrorize the populations into submission. And you have the traditional imperial ruling class of, based on Eastern capital that says, this is adventurism. We can't sustain that. You are creating the conditions for mass resistance within the United States and without, just like we went through in Vietnam in the 60s.
But Ralph, maybe I got it wrong, but it seems to me if Karl Rove, who is a rat, gets indicted by Fitzgerald, that Rove, the rat, can say, you guys are part of the group that want to prosecute me, and you're part of the group that set me up in the first place.
Well, it's the whole Hegelian dialectic. Is that right?
I mean, the problem for the lies of the neocons in order to sell the Iraq war to the American people. You know, you have to create a rationale. You have to say that there is a threat to the United States and the peoples of the world, and that is where this whole notion of weapons of mass destruction, nuclear potential weapons and biochemical weapons and all the rest of the false flag pretexts that were being galvanized for this war are put forward. The other, if after all, the architects of the first Gulf War created the same kind of lying rationale and false pretexts for the first Gulf War when they decimated Iraq from the skies.
Did Daddy Bush, according to published accounts, warn Junior that he shouldn't go ahead with the invasion of Iraq? In other words, Daddy Bush was against invading Iraq. He said, we didn't do it in Gulf War One. Why are you want to do it now? Have I got
well, there are different sectors of the class. As I say, the Zionists and the Israeli state, which are linked to the neocons and to the strategies of Rumsfeld and Cheney and their neocon apparatus, had devised this. They needed the category of terror as the rationale for carrying out this operation of dismantling each state in the Arab East.
I guess what Sherman's
older
asking
Eastern
is...
Older Eastern capital has been very reluctant about this course. They preferred what Clinton and Bush Sr. had effected, which was a blockade of Iraq that starved out and killed 1.6 million civilians and 750,000 children. They preferred then to carry out a saturation bombing with implosion weapons and high-flaring magnesium weapons that suck all the oxygen out of the air over Iraq, in which they dropped a greater amount of tonnages in 6 weeks than in all of the Second World War.
So, Ralph,
a small country of then 17 million people.
So, Ralph, really,
so yes.
Just to sum up here, because we're going to have to. We've got about 5 minutes, but I guess what you're saying is, which you've said over and many times here, and I think it's perfectly clear. And that is that both sides have the same strategy, but different tactics.
In a certain sense,
in a certain sense.
The same overall
and does
objective,
this class
a different, different strategic conception of what is to be done.
Right.
And they represent different sectors of the class because they are more rooted in finance and banking and corporate capital than they are strictly in the national security apparatus of the state, per se.
I see.
Oil. It's not unlike the forces that were lined up in the execution of Kennedy. But and the forces that were determined to have a massive half-million troop ground war in Iran. In Vietnam. I mean, with the huge profits, they're talking, the neocon agenda and their links to oil and what have you, they were projecting between $4 and $5 trillion of short-term profits to be derived from
Ralph,
the direct seizure.
A short question, Ralph. I have written exclusive stories that, and it's upset some people, that Valerie Plame's team was made up in part of people, penetration agents, who were posing as salesmen, etc., for Coca-Cola, which overseas is almost a CIA proprietary company. Is there anything about that that doesn't match in with what you've been talking about here? Or?
Well, if you really look carefully at the career and who Valerie Plame is,
yeah.
Valerie Plame's cover was Brewster Jennings, which was a proprietary company that was involved in coordinating Aramco. This was CIA's role in overseeing the control of Aramco and Saudi oil. Valerie Plame's desk is the Middle East and North Africa. As she was well described, she was very adept with an AK-47. She ain't just an information gatherer. This is a person at the center of covert operations. Her cover, her non-official cover, was Brewster Jennings, which is this proprietary company involved with Aramco, and it had to do with exercising control over Saudi oil production, and not only Saudi oil production, but the oil control through CIA of both Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, and targeting North Africa in particular. I've never seen any indication that Coca-Cola comes into it. It wasn't necessary. Her cover was Mr. Jennings. And the proprietaries that are linked to the running of the oil operations
in these parts
of the world. But the point here, the center point, and it comes back to where we started with respect to Iran, because the neocon formula for World War IV, which includes actively deploying nuclear weapons, actually using them to create the conditions in which no regime can withstand the imposition of U.S. will. Their thinking and scenario is that they will terrorize these populations into submission, and they will be able to accomplish virtually direct rule in these areas of the Arab East. And they're more sophisticated and strategically skilled counterparts in banking and corporate capital are saying, first of all, you're going to bankrupt the dollar with this deficit financing that knows no limits. You're taking surpluses and translating into trillions of dollars of short-term debt. You're going to destroy the currency. But secondly, this is a formula for setting you're acting as if you're a closet Che Guevara. 2-3 or more Vietnams. 2-3 or more Iraqs all over, 2-4 or more Vietnams all over the Arab East. You lunatics. This is what Bush Sr. and Scowcroft are saying, and that's what Fitzgerald's hatchet job role is. But these are the gentlemen killers of the CIA itself, who are in the role of saying to the neocons, you want to push us aside? Or you will have your guts for garters. You're going to displace us with your own little cabal that answers direct to you? You're going to tell us that the CIA is no longer to run these covert operations? I mean, I could give you chapter and verse of this. And so they start laying the trap.
Right.
And they have their favored assets in the media. The liberal parent, Seymour Hersh and William Arkin, these are people who have been for now going on 4 and 5 years, major disclosure stories that expose not only the strategic plans with respect to the deployment of nuclear weapons, but also the false flag. It's William Arkin who breaks the story of P2OG. P2OG is the Rumsfeld secret Pentagon plan for carrying out terror operations under the aegis of the special forces of the Pentagon. It's an admission that these terror attacks are authored by the Pentagon's special forces conjoined with the Mossad. It's P2OG that William Arkin discloses in a series of stories in the Los Angeles Times. And what we're dealing with right now, because you see, there's a war going on in the media, the Washington Times, something called Crown Watch, Israel is compelled to preempt. Cheney Cheney gives a very revealing statement to NBC and PBS. And he says, Iran is at the top of the list of trouble spots, and he asks Israel to carry out the attack. And then he says he's worried that Israel might strike to shut down Tehran's nuclear programs. He says Israel might have to do it without being asked. He says, and then this is how Zbigniew Brzezinski reacts to this Cheney announcement. Brzezinski says, yeah, he says, the vice president, in a strange parallel, is stating that the Israelis may do it, but he's using language which is a justification, and he's instructing the Israelis to do it. That's what we have here. This is Zbigniew Brzezinski. Immediately after Cheney makes this declaration, Brzezinski goes on PBS. What do you think he's saying here? Not on our watch, you son of a bitch. You're gonna have, you're gonna carry out a joint Zionist operation and drop nuclear weapons and missiles on Iran. He says this is a country four times the size of Iraq. This is a country that is linked intimately to the Shia mullahs and to the Benghazi militia in Iraq. There's 7 million people here who are going to be mobilized. Troops will be flying. You'll see the U.S. soldiers on the rooftops getting out of there in helicopters, like we saw in Saigon. See,
Ralph.
Please, Sherman. Let's just finish off.
There's an interesting column by Maureen Dowd, liberal columnist in today's New York Times, called The Autumn of the Patriarchy. And I'll just read you the last paragraph. Vice is fed up. Now, Vice is Cheney, the vice president. Vice is fed up with the whining of the squirrely surrogates, Brent Scowcroft and Lawrence Wilkerson, on behalf of George Sr. and Colin Powell. If Poppy's upset about his kid's mentor, he should be man enough to come out in the open. Poppy isn't getting Junior back, Vice vowed. He's my de facto son. It's my war.
Oh, wow.
That's Autumn of the Patriarchy by Maureen Dowd. Hey, they're not, there's nothing masked here.
I wonder what sort of a Christmas...
The neurotic camouflage is breaking down. Here you have Jim Loeb, the commentator, on yesterday, a piece that has been widely published called The Realist's Tightened Grip, as talks open with Iran. And who does he mean by the realists? He spells it out. You see, the current ambassador to Iraq, Farizad, has suddenly been sent to Iran. He's been sent to Iran to enlist Iran, who's being targeted by Cheney and the Zionists for a missile attack and for even a nuclear attack. Farizad, the ambassador to Iraq, has been sent to Iran to enlist Iran to help the United States extricate itself from Iraq. Indeed, Loeb goes on, Farizad has depicted the decision as part of a general strategy directed by realists such as George Bush Sr. and his national security advisor Brent Scowcroft, and Democrats, notably the party's ranking foreign policy spokesman Senator Joseph Biden, to enlist the cooperation of Baghdad's neighbor in stabilizing Iraq to permit a drawdown of U.S. troops. The goal is far more urgent. Public support for the United States' presence in Iraq is plummeting. Confidence in Bush's performance there and the general war on terror is falling even faster. Bush's poll numbers have now dropped to levels not seen since Richard Nixon in the early 1970s. The White House is shaken when a majority of Senate Republicans voted with the Democrats to demand that regular reports on withdrawal are presented in the Senate. And it goes on. The Pentagon is now preparing plans to withdraw. You see, so what you're looking at here, that's what the, if you want to understand Fitzgerald and Plain and Wilson and this in this uncivil war, what they're saying is, okay, we gave you guys enough rope in Iraq. We told you that you were engaged in a reckless endangerment of our class interests by overreaching there. Yeah, you make trillions of dollars in the process, but you're going to destabilize the total state control of the ruling class. And we're going to give you so much rope, and then we're coming after you. Coming after them, they are.
Listen.
I want to point out that your brilliant analysis, nobody in the mass media, regardless of which side they're on, is able to brilliantly, as you have done here tonight, analyze this situation. And that is the very reason why this program is so greatly honored with your wisdom, because you enlighten people across the board about what's happening. All these other characters pick off a little corner of the thing and don't quite enlighten us across the board. So we're truly honored with your wisdom and your commentary. You really...
Well, I appreciate that very much, Sherman. But I have to say this, you know, we've all been engaged in this investigative process, and it's sort of deja, as Yogi Berra says, it's deja vu all over
all
again.
All over again.
Because we've gone through this, and it's interesting that Joan, you know, with her book A Farewell to Justice, Unfolding the Dynamics of the Kennedy Execution, that was the template. Those same wars were being carried out over what forward strategy for subjugating Indochina. The Kennedy brothers, on behalf of the Rockefellers and Eastern Capital, in 1962, effected in Laos a cross-class government, that is to say, of the three princes. One of them, there were three brothers. One of them was a communist insurgent of the Pathet Lao. The other was a so-called neutralist who was presiding over the bourgeoisie's small but concentrated political forces in Laos. And the third was the right-wing general who was linked to the opium traffic and to the CIA. And what the Kennedy brothers effected was a cross-class government of all three princes in the same government to bring peace to Laos, so-called peace, right? Under the cover of that peace, which meant the effective emasculation and neutralizing of any resistance to U.S. designs, the Kennedy brothers, set in motion the effective Phoenix program on the ground, and they killed about 50,000 people as they proceeded systematically to carry out eliminations of union trade unionists and intellectuals and peasant leaders and all those who were trying to gain national independence and sovereignty for Laos. That's how they wanted to do it, counter-revolution on the cheap. But the Pentagon people linked to oil and to what I roughly would call new capital, no, they didn't want to use, they didn't want counter-revolution on the cheap. They wanted 500,000 U.S. soldiers on the ground and all of the hardware that goes with it in a protracted war and the profits that arise therefrom, and even to consider the prospect of going on towards China with nuclear weapons in tow. And the Kennedy brothers weren't buying into that. They were wanting, you see, the Kennedy brothers were calling for effectively what they compelled Nixon to do later, Vietnamization, where you have U.S. special forces and you have the puppet troops on the ground doing the fighting. So the Kennedy execution is about those kinds of questions, because the Kennedy brothers, they had James Gavin. You remember Colonel James Gavin, who was recommending that they scale down the Pentagon and the military, that they rely on Green Berets and Rangers. They worship James Bond. Ironically enough, it was these very death squad, killer squads that the Kennedy brothers were so interested in establishing. And the Pentagon opponents and their allies in capital, aerospace, new capital, post-45 capital, saying we ain't going to make enough money that way. And furthermore, that just gives encouragement to communists to set up political parties because they'll be incorporated. And they killed Kennedy in the process. They had their long war, and when the war blew up in their faces, hey, they pulled the plug, their opponents within the class. They disclosed Milai, Christian, all of that.
Sure.
All of that we're replaying here in Iraq.
You got to do a program about that with us also, Ralph. You are a great treasury of wisdom, and this program is really honored to have you. And the American people, this is what should be coming out of their mass communications instruments, which does not come out. They get the big lie. Here on this program, we have the honor of your brilliant analysis of what's going on, and we're all enlightened as a result, and we really thank you, Ralph.
I thank you, Sherman and Lenny.
We have you back again regularly, of course.
Of course, next, next Wednesday, every Wednesday.
We like to end with a kind of mantra, right?
Yes.
I got one for you. The bosses have two parties. We need one of our own.
Freedom will never.
We need a party independent of the ruling class and their two-state-trap political apparatus, the Democratic Republican Party.
Stay on the line, Ralph. Freedom will only be attained when the last capitalist is strangled in the entrails of the last priest.
You got it. That's Anatole France. I'll go with that.
And my salute is always the same. To hell with the Queen of England!
Read it yourself instead of asking the government why, because that will cause the propaganda to die. We'll see you again next Wednesday night, Ralph. It's a great honor having you here at Cloak and Dagger. Good night.
Good night, everybody. Thank you.
Stay on.